Blog Talk Radio.
Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report. Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report.
Yeah!
And a very, very good evening to all you Metsian folk. This is the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell, and you are here on a first-place edition of the Rising Alpha Report, episode number 132. We've made it that far. Welcome. And without further ado, I'd like to bring on one of the go-tos with this podcast. He's as big of an effort as I am, along with Mike Lacolon. Rich Sprago, started off a little bit with some shameless plugs. I really thank you for what you do on this podcast. And, let's go Mets. So welcome.
Thank you, Sam. And I'm going to throw a shameless plug right back at you because, as I've often said, when you've come on as a caller, these podcasts would not be a thing were it not for your original idea, which I believe, if my math is correct, is about 3.5 years ago that we should be doing them. And, you know, you're always the glue. You're always the one saying, hey, guys, even if I can't get on, you guys need to get on. So the Rising Apple Report owes a big debt of gratitude to you, Sam Maxwell. So it's great to join you tonight.
Well, I appreciate that too, Rich Sprago. And one more shameless plug. We have to give a shout-out to Matt Muzico, who is no longer with Rising Apple, but he was certainly at the forefront as editor at the time when we started this podcast. And, look at that, 132 episodes later. Thanks, Matt. Well,
exactly.
This is where I'm going to start. It sounds like Steven Strasburg's gotten a seven-year extension. Michael Conforto, he is quite the rising star, even though he's just been going through a slump. Mike Trout, Giancarlo Stanton, Jose Altuve. We have seen the new young generation sweep its way in, and you know, it's happened right before our eyes over these last few years. And yet Bartolo Colon is dominating the baseball headlines these days.
It's truly unbelievable. And the cliche that's going around is that Bartolo's home run broke the internet, and it probably did, you know, because everybody was tweeting it, everybody was talking about it, and it's now 2 days ago, and I was watching the Yankees earlier, and they were talking about it on the Yankee broadcast. It's just one of those things, you know. It shows you that you brought up a really nice contrast, because you have the Mike Trouts of the world, and you have the younger guys like Strasburg, and looking in our own backyard, Matt Harvey, Noah Syndergaard, these guys are in their early to mid-20s, so it's definitely a young man's game. But here comes a guy, you know, who has an amusing way about him. He has an untraditional appearance, and he whacks his first home run 2 weeks before his 43rd birthday. You can't make that up. You can't. It's just, you don't see that in other sports. You don't see the dichotomy of ages going on. You know, most other sports are very much young man's games, and baseball is too, but then you have Bartolo. So that's what makes the game great, right?
I mean, you know, I think we're all going to remember where we were when Bartolo Colon hit his first home run. I was at work, I don't have a fancy Bluetooth speaker or anything like that, which is probably better because you don't really want to override everybody else's ambiance, although I'm sure they'd be okay with me putting the game over the loudspeakers, considering Two Boots are such big fanatics. But at the same time, I kind of just like to have it on the side, and I basically just put it in a large fountain soda cup right next to the register on the left of it. And it's a very tight space, but still, you know, if I'm far away over at the oven, I'm not going to hear Howie Rose, really. I'm not going to hear the actual details of the game, even if I kind of hear a murmur in the cup. But I certainly heard something very bombastic and loud coming out of that tub. And I knew Bartolo Colon was up. And I when I heard that, and I couldn't actually make out what Howie was saying before I ran over to the cup to hear exactly what Howie was saying. And I think I missed when he said his first initial, Bartolo Colon has hit a home run, repeat. And then I probably heard the next one after he said repeat, because I heard Bartolo Colon has hit a home run, and I went ballistic. And every time I've rewatched the clip, especially the one with all three of them, Gary Cohen's, which was so magnificent, might be my favorite home run call of his. I mean, I've never heard him so excited. Howie Roseman's was fantastic, and then the Spanish one, I forget the guy's name, but I mean, I have yet to wipe the smile off my face about this. And at some point, I think I was even crying while the Spanish, like the first time I watched the whole thing, I got to the Spanish one. My tears were watering. It's a fantastic baseball moment and a great Mets moment.
It really is, you know. And if I may share just something that I think kind of puts all of it in context. So I was out Saturday night, early on in the night, and I wanted to get home relatively early in the game. So I'm driving home, and I have the game on the radio, of course. And I give you my word, I pull in the driveway, and Bartolo's up. And sometimes, as fans, you know, we stay in the car. You don't want to miss anything, right? You know, you don't want to take those 5 seconds to walk in and put it on TV. But Bartolo's up, and I said, oh, I just turned the engine off. I said, you know, he'll make his out, and I'll pick it up in the house. I go in the house. I put on the TV. You know, I actually missed it, Sam. I come on. I put the TV on. He's in the dugout. They're hitting him on the head. Gary's talking in the high-pitched voice. And I said to myself, what in the hell is going on here? And then within about 3 or 4 seconds, they're showing the replay. So I actually missed it live. And it was a conscious decision to do that because I figured I can get out of the car and not miss anything. And how about that? Huh? How about that for selling Bartolo short?
Right? I mean, it's kind of been the story since he's gotten here for you, Rich. it's funny that it happened like that in the moment, really, that you came back. You're like, what exactly is going on? And then they cut it. And I think it was the third pitch of the at-bat after a couple takes. Which is exactly what he did in his second at bat. I mean, are these at this point the most studied at bats in baseball right now?
They probably are. And, you know, it's funny because when you think about it, you see Bartolo, you see his face, and he kind of laughs, his helmet comes off. I'm going back, you know, a year earlier this year. Helmet comes off, he has that smile on his face, and everybody thinks, ha-ha, he doesn't take his at-bats very seriously. But then you hear Terry, and Terry Collins says, actually, Bartolo has a lot of pride in his at-bats. He doesn't like the fact that he doesn't look competent at the plate, and he's been working really hard at it. We've heard this for a year. We've heard this for maybe a year and a half. And if you remember, he had that double against the Marlins last year. We hit it to dead center, you know, and Howie said they're timing him with a calendar, which is great. Or I think he said a sundial. And so Bartolo, you know, as much as he would smile and laugh and kind of laugh along with it, the professional athlete in him, the competitor in him, hated it. Hated the fact that he didn't look competitive at the plate and worked on it really hard. And, you know, we started hearing word that Bartolo's been working really hard on his at-bats and in batting practice, and he's hitting the ball at the ballpark. And we all just kind of sneered and said, yeah, that'll be the day, right? But then again, you know, it shows you dedication, age doesn't matter. Dedication, competitiveness, you put it all together. Behind the scenes, he worked really hard at his craft, and he knocked one out. He knocked one out. It wasn't Yankee Stadium. It wasn't a cheapie. He knocked one out of one of the hardest home run hitters' parks in the majors. So good for him.
Yeah, really. Good for him. And it was instant history that we, you know, you kind of don't even realize while it's happening how unbelievable of a moment it is. And it's the truth that he is now the oldest player to ever hit his first major league home run, breaking the record. I mean, it's not exactly like – I guess it's not exactly a record, but it certainly is a – you know, it's that's what it is. I guess, is that what it really is called, a record? I mean, like, what do you call something like this?
Yeah, that's a record. I mean, I remember when Julio Franco hit a home run, and he was the oldest one that hit a home run at 48. So it's definitely a record. I mean, it'll go in the books. And I'll tell you what, you know, they say that, oh, never say never. Who's going to break that record? I mean, seriously. Baseball could go on for 500 more years. Who's going to hit a home run at, you know, 42 and 51 weeks? It's just not going to happen. So good, Bartolo might forever be in baseball lore for that. And it's funny because he has over 200 wins. I believe he's now the second most Dominican for Dominican pitcher. It's a lot of good stuff. But he's probably, that was probably his moment. He said as much. He said Saturday night, he said that he thought that was the defining moment of his career. And you know, again, like I said, good for Bartolo.
And it's interesting, considering he's won World Series, he's been to World Series, that what something like that, something that, I mean, it, especially because, you know, he's good at pitching. He's great at pitching. He's been fantastic over the course of his career. But hitting is not something that was his forte. And that was an absolute bomb. And good for him. You know, I could talk about it endlessly, but we're going to fade out of, about it, since there's so much to talk about with the Padres series and going to Dodgers. But really quickly, you know, we're having an RA, a Rising Apple centric podcast tonight, and we got to include our number one caller, and that is Long Island Mike. Long Island Mike, thanks for joining us. And you know, you're young. You're 15 years old. You know, you are certainly, you know, there's a good balance of ages on the show right now. You know, with me being 31 and Rich, I don't know, I don't want to announce your age. I don't think I know it anyway, but it's a good balance here. Long Island Mike, you know, what do you think about Bartolo Colon?
I personally love him. He's big sexy. I was so happy when I had him. When he hit the home run. In fact, I was playing MLB 16 the show, and then I turned on the Mets game and Bartolo's batting. I'm like, okay, let me watch it. Next pitch, he hits the home run. I start laughing. And that was no cheap shot either. The thing I found really nice, though, was a Mets fan caught it, and the Mets fan didn't want anything back in return for the ball. That's what really touched me.
Yeah, that was really, really special.
That touched me.
Yeah, that was really special to hear. And the guy was a born and bred Mets fan from Southern California, but his parents are from Buffalo. He was able to get some photo ops. You know, this stuff is, well, he's going to be, it sounds like Bartolo is going to be keeping the bat and ball. Maybe sending the helmet to the Hall of Fame, which is fantastic, Rich. I have to say that if the helmet winds up there, it's been such a big part of the repertoire of Bartolo Colon's at-bats and the way it spins off sometimes when he takes such a mighty cut. I mean, that is just something that's going to keep putting a smile on my face when I go to Cooperstown and see that at the Hall of Fame.
Oh, for sure. And I think if they want to have the helmet there and they want to show a tape loop of it falling off his head as he swings, I realize, like I said before, he has a lot of pride, he's a professional athlete and all that stuff, but that also shows that this game can be fun. And why not? You know, you have all these serious things in the Hall of Fame. Everybody, you know, why is Pete Rose not here and all this stuff? And it's great stuff, as we know. But why not have a little diversion from all that? Have a helmet, have a continuous tape loop of it falling off Bartolo's head and say, you know what? Yeah, maybe he looked like that, but this also was on his head when he became the oldest player to hit his first major league home run. So I think that would be a nice little diversion, and it's something that, you know, Sam, when you have kids, you could take your kids up there and see that and say, hey, I saw that, you know, and explain the whole thing and just have a fun moment with it.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'll be going to the Hall of Fame in a few weeks, actually. But go ahead, Long Island.
If and when Bartolo Colon becomes a Hall of Famer, what team does he go in at?
And that's a good question, Rich. Do you think that if, I mean, honestly, when is this man going to stop? I could considering the level he's still doing it at, you know, unlike, you know, Julio Franco certainly wasn't an everyday player as he went into his 40s. But, I mean, if Bartolo Colon can keep being this effective, I mean, why not?
Well, you know, is he a Hall of Famer? I don't know. I've heard a debate about that very recently. I think it was on Ed Randall's show on Sunday. They were asking, and he may not be. You know, if you look at his numbers over his career, 221 wins, 300 is the automatic ticket, right? So 221, let's say he gets to 230, 235. That's still a good clip away from – it's a pretty good clip away from 300, which is the automatic ticket for a pitcher. So very solid statistics. And his career ERA, though, is pushing 4, 395. So if you look at it like that, you know, a lot of longevity and all that stuff, a lot of strikeouts and all, but the Hall of Fame is for the most elite players ever. And I don't know. I mean, do you consider Bartolo to be an elite pitcher for a significant period of time? I don't. He's had a couple of good years. I remember when he came up with Cleveland, and you know, and I know we've all seen that, you know, throwing gas up there, and you know, 14-9 one year, 18-5 another, 15-8. But then he kind of flattens out. He had a 20-8 season in there. And then he had a bunch of, you know, pedestrian years till he gets to 2005, where he went 21-8. So, you know, he had a couple of really good years. But what people say, other than the automatic bids, like career 300 hitter, 300 wins as a pitcher, that if you're going to be in the Hall of Fame, you should have been able to dominate the sport for a 10-year period. Bartolo doesn't have that. He has scattered instances of being at the top of the game, but not for a consistent period of time. So I'm going to say I don't think he is a Hall of Famer.
I'd have to agree with you with the pedestrian ERA, you know, but at what point, like with some of this, I guess maybe you have to think, like, at what point do you is it just the personality? I don't know. I mean, like, when you think about the Hall of Fame, I agree with you with that, the whole 10-year period. I think the 300 number is getting less and less. But, you know, he's certainly top Dominican, you know, one of the top Dominican pitchers of all time. And he's making his mark regarding that. He already has a statue down there, but he's already making his mark regarding that. I mean, he passed Pedro for crying out loud. It's just he's up there. With elite numbers, even if, you know, an elite player is, even if that pedestrian ERA is still there, because, you know, we've seen it, you know, he, like the other day, he gave up a 3-run home run, even on that day, but he, outside of that one pitch, he was pretty sound and, you know, kept the Padres at bay. And I think that's a good segue here, the Padres. Away from Bartolo Colon, with that Padres series, I mean, the Mets could have taken more advantage of the sweep of the Cubs, but at the same time, I mean, you know, I wrap back around to Bartolo Colon a little bit, because it did kind of remind me of 2014, the way that his double kind of ignited this team a little bit, and I thought that after those couple days, Rich, of just absolute awfulness from the Mets offense, Bartolo Colon woke them up a little bit.
I think he did. I think he did, and you know, and I've been watching this game for a long time, watching this team for a long time, and for some reason, the Mets have always seemed to struggle in San Diego. You know, I've seen them in their heyday do well in L.A. I've seen them do well in San Francisco, but, you know, just shooting from memory, it just seems like San Diego is a very tough place for them to play, and for no good reason. Obviously, the teams are different. The players are different. It's just something about it. And so, yeah, they went into their malaise the first couple of games, and then lo and behold, they have Big Game James on the mound, and it's like, oh, boy, you know, Pomerantz is really good, but Big Game James is their guy, and now you have to face him. And you're like, geez, we're going to lose the first three games of this series. But you're right, Sam. Bartolo, you know, look at what they did. He hits the home run. They do that silent treatment that was epic. I've never seen that. I've seen, you know, we've all seen the silent treatment for, you know, so many different reasons. These guys left the bench and went into the clubhouse. That is epic stuff. I love that. That snapped them out of something. Maybe it was a cohesion moment. I don't know what it was. But, yeah, I think you're right. You know, I think the levity brought by the home run and all of that may have been the impetus for them winning that game and salvaging the split.
And for a while there, Bartolo Colon's home run was the difference until the couple solo shots in the in the ninth inning. And I think that, you know, going to Matt Harvey on Sunday, which is interesting to combine this with also the fact that Steven Strasburg, a Boris client, just got a seven-year extension and talking about Matt Harvey. But what I really liked about that game was, you know, the talk even at the end of Saturday's night game had to do with the fact that it was still all from the home run, 6-3, all from the home run. And starting with Eric Campbell with a dribble up the middle, they got a few hits with runners in scoring position and other than home runs, and it was nice to see.
It really was. And I don't know if this is the time to get into this, and maybe it isn't, but, you know, if I had a concern about this team, I think we all have the same concern, is they're scoring, what, you know, 55% of their runs on home runs. And the big concern with that is obviously when you get to the postseason, and let's hope they do, you're facing better pitching, and, you know, the home run ball may not be quite as bountiful then. And you know, do you have a fallback plan? So, but, yes, to your point, Sunday was great to see them score some runs the old-fashioned way. You know, even Matt Harvey himself got in on the offense. And like you said, Eric Campbell had two of the softest base hits you'll ever see, but they were effective. So good for that. And, yeah, and it was nice to see Sunday's game was by far the best Mets game of this season. I don't think anybody would deny that. I mean, between, you know, the Houdini act of Bastardo, Harvey coming back to form with 10 Ks, and the diversified offense, you know, a little bit with the long ball and a lot without it. So, so things are trending up. I thought Sunday's game was great and certainly sets them up for this rematch of the NLDS with the Dodgers.
Yep. And that's going to be very exciting. Long Island Mike, regarding Matt Harvey regarding like Steven Strasburg and Boris, we all know what you think about Matt Harvey, but outside of your emotions of whether or not you'd want to keep this guy, do you think now that this might shine some light on the possibility that Matt Harvey would want to talk in extension?
Well, that's a very good question that I was thinking, too, to prove that we are also going to compete with the Nationals. Because in my opinion, even though I hate Matt Harvey is better than Steven Strasburg. But, yes, I would try to get into contract negotiations. If he doesn't want to do it, whatever. Screw him. But it's worth a shot.
Well, I mean, Rich, right now, I don't know if the Mets are inclined to even discuss a contract extension the way things have been going right now.
Well, the Mets are going to have to pick their spots. They've got four guys who, and if you want to count Wheeler, they've got five, who are young guys who you potentially might want to offer an extension to, and you certainly can't offer it to all five of them. So the question becomes, is it three? Is it two? So it's not so much, you know, philosophically, should you offer a pitcher a mega extension like Strasburg's, which, of course, we all know they'll regret. The Nats will regret that in 2 or 3 years.
They overpaid him.
Oh my God! Did they ever?
Speaking of that, real quick, the Nats did tie the Tigers 4-4. I believe it's either the 6th or 7th. But they also left the bases loaded. The Tigers got out of that, so that's something to keep monitoring. And anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So the Mets not only have to, you know, determine philosophically, does it make sense to offer a pitcher a contract that's so lucrative to a point where that pitcher won't go free agent. It has to be some pretty, you know, darn big bucks to do that. But then they have to answer the second question, which is, of the five of these guys, who, how many, and once you make that answer, which ones? So do they say, look, we're going to try to retain three of them? And then how do you factor that? Do you go for the ones who haven't had surgery yet? Do you go for the ones that, you know, like a DeGrom, who's a little bit older, or maybe you can get him a little bit cheaper, so he's one of them, and then you pick the other two? I don't know. So the Mets have a lot of questions to answer when it comes to potentially locking up a couple of their young starters in the way that the Nats did with Strasburg.
Can I tell you who I would choose?
Sure.
Sure. Right now, I would choose Steven Matz, Jacob DeGrom, and Noah Syndergaard. No doubt. That's just my opinion, though.
Noah Syndergaard, those guys. What's really interesting about the whole thing is the fact that they're kind of all over the board when they become free agents, Rich.
Yep, it's true.
What is Steven Matz 8-1 in his career so far? And did
Steven Matz is the one the farthest away, and that's about 6 years, I believe, till he would be a free agent. Jacob, I think, is only, Rich, help me out here, 3-4 years away?
I will pull Jacob up. I'm pulling him up as we speak. So, but, you know, to comment on what Long Island Mike just said, I actually think those are pretty good choices. DeGrom is a free agent 2021, so we have him a few more years.
5 years.
Yeah, DeGrom is first free agent 2020, so after the 2020 season.
We're looking at Matt Harvey, you know, is the one up. You know, I'm not sure where Wheeler came up in 14, and Matt Harvey came up in 2012. So basically Wheeler would be 2020, and that means that and Noah Syndergaard we have to, like, I think 2020. 2020 or 2021 as well. Actually, he's the exact same thing as Matt. So, yeah, I mean, Matt Harvey's the first one to go, and they might be inclined to still let him walk. But I've wondered what exactly would the impact be if he goes to the Yankees from a psychological perspective. I mean, everybody thinks that he's going to go because of the whole, growing up a Yankee fan and whatnot. And if he's going to go anywhere, he's going to stay in New York. I don't know whether I'd be as bothered as I thought I'd be. Maybe because, you know, I thought I was going to be really bothered about Beltran going there. But, you know, that really, the whole thing hasn't really worked out over there. And with where the Yankees are, they have a lot to figure out from a personal franchise perspective currently. But I don't know. I'll start with Rich, and then I'll see what Long Island Mike has to think.
Well, you know, you have to make your choices, right? So if you look at Matt Harvey first, he's the first one that eligible for free agency, as we've talked about. My philosophy on him is straighten him out. Let him end up with a, 15-10 record this year or something along those lines, and trade him at the end of the season. I mean, you're not going to retain this guy. You know, we're all shaking our heads in disbelief that Boris actually let Strasburg sign the extension. He's not going to let Harvey do it, and Harvey may not want to do it. There are way too many factors pointing to Harvey leaving this team. Maybe they don't want to spend what he wants or whatever the case might be, the whole Yankee thing. Let him straighten his stuff out and trade him while you can get something for him. I like Harvey too, but look, that's the right move. We all know that. When it comes to Wheeler's the biggest work in progress the Mets have. You know, he's coming off of Tommy John, and we're going to see what happens for the balance of this year, and that's not even going to be a good barometer. So maybe you see what he does in 2017 and think about moving him too, because – like I said, he was a work in progress before the surgery. He's certainly going to be one after the surgery. Those might be the two that you have to let go. And like Long Island Mike said, you know, DeGrom, I have my concerns about, but I think there's enough there to a point where I would be interested in keeping him. Syndergaard right now, he's pretty much the franchise. I mean, the three most popular people on this team are Syndergaard, Cespedes, and Wright. And Wright is
Bartolo.
Only because he has been. And, well, yeah, Bartolo has his moments. So we'll call him number four. But so Syndergaard definitely has to be retained. DeGrom might be the most affordable. And then I agree about Matt's. I love having a lefty in the lineup. I love having in the rotation. I love having a hard throwing lefty in the rotation. So if I were sitting in the GM's chair and I were projecting out, let's say 2 years from now, yeah, I'd be building around those three, definitely trading the other two, and then obviously you have to think about who your other two starters are going to be. You have to try to find them somewhere in the organization. Maybe you can bring back a young arm. But I think that's how I'd approach it.
I have a question. We have a knuckleballer down in Double A or Triple A, right? Is that true?
I don't think it's Triple A. I don't know the name of it. Rich, do you know anything about this knuckleballer?
I've heard of him. I think he's Double A. I'll try to find the name, but go ahead.
Yeah,
Well, if we do trade Matt Harvey and Zach Wheeler at the time, the knuckleballer is ready. It's the time we're probably going to trade Zach Wheeler. So there's another starter if we keep him and he succeeds.
I mean, Bartolo Colon might not be retained by the Mets next year, so you can trade Matt Harvey and sign Ari Dickey.
Yeah.
and here's, it's an interesting segue. You were just mentioning the knuckleballer, and I'm looking his name up. But I don't know. I've always thought, I really wouldn't mind if Ari Dickey came back finish his career off with one more year as a New York Met. And I don't know if – I don't think it's in the cards. I don't know whether that's something that that Sandy Alderson would be open to. I guess you always need a veteran guy. I think maybe at this point you could talk R.A. into coming out of the bullpen as a different-look pitcher. And who knows? But I don't know, Rich, throwing a little digression out that way. What do you think of that?
Well, there's that whole thing with what we don't know is, was R.A. Dickey really bad in the clubhouse like they said he was? I mean, the reporters didn't like him, that's clear. When he was traded, they said he was all about himself and this, that, and the other thing. So is there more to R.A. Dickey than meets the eye? That's the first question. We don't know the answer. So is it something where Sandy would say, if I'm bringing in a 40, what would he be by that time, 42-year-old veteran knuckleballer, which is fine because those guys can go forever. But is there that additional factor that when he was here, he was not good in the clubhouse? Because if you're going to bring in somebody like that, you want that person to be good in the clubhouse or in the bullpen or what have you. So from a utility perspective, sure. Dickey could be your swing man. He could be your long reliever, spot starter. He's definitely a fan favorite. But the thought about bringing him back, yeah, I like it personally, but there's a lot there. We'd really have to get underneath this issue of just what was R.A. Dickey like? Was he as bad as he's made out to be? And would that be a mitigating factor?
I think that was overblown because everybody – it's kind of the same thing when people were saying about Johannes Cespedes being bad in the clubhouse. I mean, something doesn't seem right when David Wright says, R.A. Dickey's one of the best teammates I've ever had. I don't know whether that's exactly, what it's about. But at the same time, when you see the way they've shaped this team, with the press, the same thing happened to Ike Davis, that Ike Davis was too much of a party guy. And he got shipped out of here, and Turner got shipped out of here. It's interesting to consider and how much I actually like this group of people, even if I definitely have a place in my heart for those early Sandy Alderson teams, actually. Long Island Mike, just take it wherever you want to go from there.
Well, I really don't like R.A. Dickey. He's had a bad career except that one good year with the Mets. Okay, whatever. Don't have him back. You have Logan Verrett, who, honestly, if he's in the rotation, could be probably an ace. It's by his spot starts, he looks amazing. So there's another starter right there. But for utility purposes, I highly doubted Sandy would do this because of our money issues. I still don't see how they got the money to sign Cespedes and all, but, you know. But I don't think they would do it for money issues. And then also on your comment for Matt Harvey to the Yankees, I don't think that will happen. I think the Yankees are more interested in Bryce Harper and the Dodgers are going to sign Matt Harvey.
Oh, they're going to try to convert him to L.A., huh?
Yep.
Well,
so.
Well, it's certainly something to keep an eye on. It's going to be – I love following this team, and I love following this sport. And speaking of which, Rich, you know, I've been paying attention around the league a little bit. You know, I've been using the MLB TV that I have. And I have to say, this has been a fantastic season so far.
For baseball in general, it really has.
Baseball in general, yeah.
It really has. There's a lot of intrigue going on. There's, you know, you have the National League East, which is shaping up exactly the way people thought it would. With it, it's a two dog fight. Yeah, the Phillies are in it, but they're not really going to be around long. At least I don't think so. The Marlins are going to be pesky, so the National League East is shaping up, you know, pretty much the way we thought. A couple things aren't happening the way people thought. You know, the Blue Jays are under 500, and they're struggling. How about that National League West? You know, the first place team is basically a 500 team. So you have the Dodgers, Giants, and Diamondbacks all right around 500. And who expected that? And how about those White Sox? You know, the White Sox under Robin Ventura, you know, nobody expected that. The Cubs, that's a story, right? Because it isn't very often that you're 24-6. And, you know what they remind me of? This is going too far back for you guys, but in 84, the Detroit Tigers got out of the gate. I want to say they were 35-5 in their first 40.
That's what it was.
Yeah, so 35-5 in their first 40. And it's like, wow. And then when they got to the postseason, because it's a brand-new ball game, of course, and they did. The Tigers kept it up, and they won the World Series. So the Cubs are a big story. There's a lot of individual stuff. You know, the emergence of some young players, like the shortstop in Colorado, hitting a lot of home runs. So, yeah, it has been good. The weather's been terrible, which I think has kept a lot of the crowds down in the East and Midwest, but I think that'll change now that the weather's getting warmer. And I do think baseball is coming out of the gates pretty well in 2016.
May I comment on that real quick?
Sure.
Absolutely.
On that Sunday against whatever team, the Giants, when Thor Mad Bum pitched, I had Citi Field to myself for like 2 hours until fans started showing up because of the rain. I was literally the only one in Citi Field. It was so nice. I'm like, I'm the landlord now.
It must have been an interesting feeling. It kind of reminds me. We'll talk very briefly about the Giants and the Dodgers, and especially you know playing the Dodgers. It's always going to be interesting, and we'll talk about 1932 briefly in a little bit. But I read somewhere after the Dodgers vacated Ebbets Field, this one guy used to come there. Like, the place was open completely to the public all day long, and there was just basically one Dodgers representative there making sure that – because until 1960, the Dodgers still had the lease. And there was this one guy – you know, some people came on their lunch from work to read the newspaper, but one dude just went out there sometimes by himself, other than this attendant of Ebbets Field, and just stared at the field looking for basically days-long pass, probably. But that's what that reminded me of real quick. And speaking of the Dodgers, that's a good segue – going into this series, Rich, you know, it's the first time they're taking them on since the division series. And I think for me, in terms of retribution for Chase Utley, I think something subtly might happen at some point. But I think you got to – I've always liked what David Wright was saying last year and still to this day was that the biggest revenge we can get is just by beating them.
Yeah, you know – I agree with that. And I think on this podcast I've taken the controversial stand that I don't think they should throw at Utley. And I know a lot of Met fans want blood, and I totally get that. But if you think about that, so, first of all, if it's going to happen, it has to happen in his first at-bat tonight, and you get it over with. You don't let this linger. You just take care of business if that's what you're inclined to do. Mats is going to have to hit him first time up and go from there and put it behind you. Now, the reason I don't favor that is, so what do the Dodgers do? Do they throw at Yoenis Cespedes? And what if Cespedes breaks a bone in his hand and we don't have him for 10 weeks? What the hell's the point? You know, the Mets beat the Dodgers in the series. They, like David said, like you said, Sam, they got their revenge that way. Let it go, guys. It's a new season. I don't want to see them throw it Utley because I don't want the Dodgers throwing at one of the Met players. I'm all about business this year. I don't want to be without Cespedes. I don't want to be without Cabrera. I don't want to be without anybody. So I really hope they don't do it. They got their revenge last year by beating them. So that's my hope. You know, that's my hope. And I'll say again what I've said before in this podcast is that did Utley slide late? Yes. Utley should have been, it should have been a double play. We all know that by rule. He could not make contact with the bag. He slid late. It was interference, double play. Absolutely. Was he trying to hurt Ruben Tejada? I don't believe he was. You'd have to be premeditated to do that. He wasn't trying to break Tejada's leg. He wasn't playing dirty. It was a late slide that he, by rule, should. It was an illegal slide. It sure was. And it came out as being dirty. It looked dirty, but he wasn't trying to hurt the guy. And, again, I'll say one more time, it's going to be in about 30 minutes from now. We'll see what they do, but just don't throw at him because I don't want to beanball war at these guys. I want to win the World Series this year, and I want to win it with Cespedes. I don't want to be without him.
Exactly. And speaking of Cespedes, man, I mean, he's having a stretch very similar to what he did last year.
Incredible. You know, there were some Met fans who said, don't bring him back. You know, he's a cancer. He's all this. You know, he smokes and nobody wants to be around him and all this kind of nonsense. And then to your earlier point, Sam, other people refuted that, saying he's a great teammate. But the guy is a machine. You know, does he have holes in his swing? Of course he does. You can get him out. You can get anybody out. But the guy is a force on the baseball field between his arm, his bat. You know, every time he comes up, it's must-see TV as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, Yoenis Cespedes, you know, we had that podcast the next day in the blizzard, right, the day after he signed. We knew it bode well for the 2016 season, and it's playing out that way. You know, he's first in RBI, second in home runs in the National League, and he's the man. You know, he loves the fans. The fans love him. It's great. Why would you not want this? I was surprised anybody would say they didn't want Cespedes back.
Yeah, this has just been fantastic. He's certainly my favorite player on the team right now. And other than of course, Bartolo Colon, Long Island Mike. what's your take right now?
Cespedes is hot right now, thank God. But you know what? Who said we had to hit Utley? Who said that? We could hit Clayton Kershaw if we wanted to. It doesn't have to retaliate against Utley.
But that's almost even worse.
I don't care. He broke my shortstop leg. He couldn't move for a while. Do something where someone can't move for a while. He broke my shortstop leg, and I'm still pissed about it.
Hey, man, you know, I get it. Some people just are really upset at Chase Utley, and it certainly has a lot to do with what he's been doing for years, Rich. You know, the fact that he was also a Philly.
Go ahead.
Well, if you recall, I believe it was, I'm 99% sure, it was a 2010 season. It was a late season game. I believe it was late August. And Utley went in hard at Tejada. Tejada was filling in for Reyes. And after the game, I'll never forget it, David Wright said, I'm going to start reevaluating the way I go into second base. The next night, he went in hard at Utley. So, yeah, Utley has a history. It's not just the Mets. He has a history of doing that. He's a hard-nosed player. that, and it comes across, and rightfully so, as being a little chippy at times. But again, you know, I know a Long Island Mike wants to pound the flesh. Fine. A lot of people say that. I go the other way with it. Just my opinion.
Yeah, I would have to agree. You know, like I said, let's beat these guys. These guys have not really looked all that good. You know, as the National League West is not. You know, it's about time that the Mets just put the pedal to the metal. I mean, you know, we still have to see what happens in this Nats game right now. It's two on, two out, in I believe the top of the eighth, and that pop up gets out. Or was it caught? I don't. No, it wasn't caught. Okay, it bounced. I don't know.
Today the New York Mets retweeted and favored my tweet, saying when I tagged him saying I have to watch the Mets game tonight, hashtag Utley sucks. They retweeted it and favored it. So maybe they are in for some revenge. Never know.
Because of the Twitter account.
Yeah, because never know.
Because the guy in the office got the call from David Wright.
Yep. You got to have conspiracies.
I love it, man. I love it. So we still have to see what's going on with this game. But, you know, the Mets have a chance, with the Nats struggling recently, to really take the pedal to the metal and take over this division. I don't, you know, I think it's going to be a hard-nosed fight. And, you know, in about a week and a half, I believe we're taking on the Nats team. So I think that the Mets need to keep the pedal to the metal, Rich, and just keep the winning going against these Dodgers who have been sputtering a little bit.
Well, really what it's going to come down to when you really think about it is the Mets and Nats will probably play about even against the rest of the league, right? Because they're very evenly matched teams. So I think the differential between what they do against the rest of the National League, the rest of their schedule, I think it'll be minimal. And they have 19 games with each other. That's your division right there. So, you know, if God forbid, it's like it was a couple of years ago where the Nats won 14 of 19, well, I think we know what's going to happen. But, you know, if the Mets can beat them 11 out of 19 or something like that, like they did last year, I think it was 12 out of 19, then great. You know, then that might be the division. So that's what I see. So I think the Mets have to hold serve against the rest of the National League. You know, do your thing, 500 or a little better on the road, you know, better than that at home against everybody else. And when you play the Nats, you have to – that's your season. That's your – certainly your division and maybe your shot at a wild card. So – and it all starts, I believe, it's next Tuesday night, a week from tomorrow night.
That's remarkable. And you know what? I'm now really appreciating the fact that they set it up for a mid-May match, for the first match of the year. It seemed as if, and by the way, I sounded a little bit European, like I was talking about a soccer match right there. The game is next week. You know, at first I was like, I can't believe they don't take each other on, but I think the schedule makers, the schedule gods, had, you know, I think they had an idea about, you know, the drama of it all.
Money, agreed. Money.
We're coming up to, I believe first pitch is going to be a 10-10, so we're going to segue out so everybody can watch the game starting at 10 o'clock. It's episode 132, so we're going to be talking a little 1932 of New York National League legacy, and especially with us going out to Dodger Stadium, it's always fine to correlate to the Brooklyn Dodgers of 1932, which is interesting. They finished third in the National League at 81-73 that year, and that kind of says a lot about about what they were at the time. They never kind of got over the hump during this era from 1920 to 1939. For some reason, I am, my baseball references paused. There we go, it's picking up, probably because I have the Nats game on. Everything's a little slower. Their best player on this team, and it's just so funny to see the dichotomy of WAR listed for these players, but that's a pretty high WAR for Lefty O'Doul, 6.3 WAR, and I believe Lefty O'Doul was a pitcher, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see. No, he was an outfielder. He was an outfielder. That year, he batted .368 with a. I know you hear Lefty O'Doul, you think he's going to be a sixth outfaw, but he batted .368 with a .423 on base percentage and .555 slugging, with 21 home runs and 90 RBIs. That's pretty remarkable. And actually, Hack Wilson was on this team, who's a famous. I'm guessing he was. No, he was. He was the fourth. He was the fourth in WAR for the 1932 Brooklyn Dodgers. But, I believe Hack Wilson's a Hall of Famer, and this year for the Dodgers, he had 23 home runs and 123 RBIs with a .297 batting average. It's interesting going all the way back here and seeing this stuff and, you know, seeing names like Clyde Supeforth and Alta Cohen, Ike Boone, Danny Taylor. I mean, Danny Taylor sounds like somebody, Rich, that Sandy Alderson took off the trapeze.
Yeah, either that or somebody who was on Full House. That's actually Danny Tanner, so I couldn't resist that, Sam. I'm sorry.
No, please, by all means. Going over to the 1932 New York Giants, Brooklyn faithful love to see this. Finished sixth in the National League at 72-82. John McGraw. This was John McGraw's last season, and after going 17-23, Rich, I'm not sure if you know. We need Mike Lacolon, who would definitely be able to tell us a little bit about this right now. But John McGraw, I know he had failing health at the time. Let's see when he died. He might have died this year. But Bill Terry took over and went 55-59 after John McGraw left. Legendary manager with a 17-23 record. Do you know any? You know, do you have any idea about that and John McGraw this season, Rich?
You know, I don't, Sam. And the thing I know is that John McGraw, obviously, like you said, legendary manager of the Giants, and he, I know he was in failing health. I'm not sure if he passed that year or if he stepped out of baseball and passed shortly thereafter. So, the name is legendary in baseball, but I honestly don't know a lot about the man himself.
Yeah. He was from the old school he certainly played a little bit dirty at certain points, or had people play dirty, as it was kind of the standard. It was a rough game at the time when John McGraw played for not only the Baltimore Orioles, but actually, wait a second, I don't think he ended up going to Brooklyn. I'm sorry that I'm all over the place with my memory about some of this history, but he did play for the legendary Baltimore Orioles of the late 1890s. Before that entire team basically got traded to, because at the time apparently you could own two teams, and the Baltimore Orioles and the Brooklyn Dodgers united, and well, they weren't the Dodgers really at the time, but they ended up being the Superbos because Ned Hanlon, who was the manager of the Baltimore Orioles, ended up becoming the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers in, I believe, 1899 and 1900. And they were the best team in the league that year, and their fans called them the Superbos. But we're not talking about number 99 right now, so maybe we'll give a shout out to that 1899 team at the time that we come around to number 99 when we talk about the 99 team with episode 199. It's interesting going all the way back, seeing some of these names, and just real quick. Regarding the 1932 New York Giants, Mel Ott, of course, the Hall of Famer, was the best on that team with a 7.9 WAR. And that year, he batted .318 with a .424 on base percentage and a .601 slugging with 38 home runs and 123 RBIs. That's a pettis line I would love to see for this year at the end of it. And we segue over to number 32, which is a very interesting list, and it's going to be interesting talking about some of these players. You got Jack Hamilton, Hal Rennes, John Matlack, which is certainly who you think about along with Steven Matz right now. You know, both lefties. Tom Houseman, Carlos Diaz, Dick Kidrow, Kevin Mitchell, Rick Anderson, Tom Eden, Mark Carrion, Doc Edwards, Bill Pakoda, Johnny Stevenson, Pete Smith, Paul Wilson, Mike Hansen, Brett Hinchliffe, wow, Bruce Chen, Tyler Yates, Mike Stanton, Danny Graves, Jeremiah Gonzalez, Eli Marrero, Dave Williams, Carlos Muniz, Henry Mejia, McCroy Hawkins, John Lannon, and Steven Matz. Rich, I got to start with you. What are some of those names that really pop out to you?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. The first one that pops out is John Matlack. When you think about it, when Matlack came up, the staff was Kuzmin and Seaver. It was them, and it was Gary Gentry to a lesser degree. And here comes this highly touted lefty. I'm not sure what you guys know about Matlack, but two of the more defining moments of his career. First, he was, I believe, in his second year, and he was hit in the forehead by a line drive off the bat of Marty Perez of the Atlanta Braves. I remember watching that on TV, and he collapsed, and he had a fractured skull. He missed a couple months. So I remember that about John Matlack, and I remember, I believe it was his rookie season, or maybe it was his next season, he was an All-Star, and he was co-MVP of the All-Star game, and that game was actually ironically played in Kansas City. So Matlack, he had some great years as a Met, and you know, left when the team started rebuilding, or they weren't even rebuilding yet, they were just dismantling. So he was traded to Texas, I believe, after the 1977 season. So when the Mets just went into the doldrums. So I think about Matlack. And then I think about Tom Houseman for one reason. In the mid-70s, when free agency became a thing, the Mets were roundly criticized for they had never signed a free agent. They just didn't believe in it. They felt, you know, oh, you know, we're going to build our team through the minor leagues and we don't do free agency, and the fans were irate. The first free agent they ever signed was Tom Houseman. And he was a journeyman right-hander, solid pitcher, good curveball, you know, sort of like a fifth starter swingman. But he was the Mets' first foray into free agency. So I think about Tom Houseman. As I look down this list, you know, I'm a big Steven Matz fan. I said that earlier, and I stick to it. So I'm glad Steven Matz is sporting number 32 these days. And, you know, just to make a comment on anybody else, well, I'll say this. Bill Pakoda, I remember when the Mets got him, I believe he was in the Greg Jeffries trade. And they got Bill Pakoda from the Royals with Brett Saberhagen. He was a throw-in in the Brett Saberhagen deal. So Pakoda was a guy who was sort of like a utility player, you know, scrappy, smart player, very short Mets tenure. I think it was no more than a year or two. So I think about him, and, yeah, those would be my comments on some of the guys who've worn 32 for the blue and orange.
Yeah, Long Island Mike, you know, you're age 15, you're a lot younger, so I think I'm sure, like, some names like LaTroy Hawkins, Henry Mejia, John Lannon stick out more to you than some of the other names on there. What do you think about something that some of these guys that you've heard?
Steven Matz. He's meet the match. He's going to be dominant in his career. In fact, he's pitching tonight. Hopefully he'll do good, which he should be. He dominated the Dodgers in his first start against them. So, yeah, he's something. He's going to be an ace. And then I'm going to go Henry Mejia. No way is that guy stupid enough to take steroids three times. I read an article that some type of meat was causing positive steroid test, so maybe it was that, or maybe his cook or whatever he has, or someone that doesn't like him, gave him steroids. I don't know, but no way that guy is stupid enough to do it three times.
Rich, you know, Henry Mejia's name is on this list, and he wasn't wearing it when he came back in 2014, but he wore it from 4-7-2010 to 9-30-2012, the number 32. And I think at the time it said a lot about where they thought Henry Mejia was on the list, giving him such a low number when he first came up.
although I think he also shouldn't have come up as early as he did. So, I
think it's one of the big, this whole thing, it's just one of the biggest, weirdest mysteries surrounding this whole steroid thing. I just didn't see this coming with Henry Mejia.
No, I didn't either. And I'm not sure if you guys listen to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball on Sunday mornings, but he had Chris Colabello on last week. And Chris Colabello, as you know, was recently suspended for 80 games, Blue Jays, recently suspended for PEDs. And Colabello swears he never touched stuff. And he said he's meticulous. You know, and a lot of guys have said this, you know, that I'm meticulous about what I put in my body. And Colabello's story is a little bit different. You know, he was one of those guys, he was in the independent leagues, and he really, you know, fought tooth and nail just to get into the major leagues, and he's done quite well with Toronto. So he said, after, you know, going down the paths I've gone down, why would I risk my career for something that stupid? So getting back to what you guys have been saying, he insists that he did not take a performance-enhancing drug. He was actually found, what was found in him was a metabolite of a performance-enhancing drug. So what that means is that his body broke something down, and a metabolite was found. That's a metabolite found in a performance-enhancing drug. So he's convinced that it was something he ate or something that's completely legal that the body metabolized into this performance-enhancing drug. And how does that relate to Henry Mejia? I actually agree with you guys. Nobody's that stupid. I think that it's just a case of he's taking something, eating something that the test maybe is more sophisticated than what he's eating or taking, and it found a metabolite somewhere. Because apparently with Colabello, they found a metabolite of a very old steroid from like the 80s when it was popular. So I just don't think guys are doing that anymore. So I think it's great that baseball is drug testing. And I think it's great that that they're trying to clean the game up and have everybody competing on an even playing field. But I don't know. Something tells me there's a lot of false positives out there.
Yeah.
Something seems not right. And you know, this is an ever going process with this whole steroid thing. You know, they have to figure out something sounder. Just to get this right, if players are feeling as if it's not properly weeding it out, then you know that's going to come up at some point. So we'll see how it all goes. And I think with that, without further ado, we're going to segue over to our last word. I'm going to start with pedal to the metal. I'm going to keep that, you know, keep banging that drum. That's just what the Mets need to do. Unfortunately, my video is freezing a little bit, so I don't exactly know what the Tigers might be doing in this top of the ninth. But this is what baseball is all about, and it's fun to see this start to really be quite the divisional race we're going to see right here. So Mets need to just put the pedal to the metal and take control. So. Let's go Mets, and without further ado, Rich, what is your last word?
My last word is roll, as in ROLL. So my thoughts are very similar to yours, Sam. The Mets just have to keep it rolling. You know, at times it could be a little surprising because it's all on the home run and it might be concerning that way. But whatever they're doing, it's working. They're 19-11. Keep the roll going. Let's not let anything stupid happen. Let's not get anybody hurt. Let's just keep doing what we're doing, because if you could play at a 19-11, if you could win 19 out of every 30, you're going to be in really good shape at the end of the season. So let's keep guys healthy. Let's not do anything crazy, and let's just keep rolling.
Long on, Mike.
Okay, so have someone hit someone in sometime this series, or just wait till they get home. On the face of Dodgers, and don't look at first pitch fastballs right down the middle. That has been killing the Mets, in my opinion. They need to swing the bat at first pitch fastballs down the middle. That's all I need to say, and our offense will be better than what it is now. And let's go Mets.
And let's go Mets. And just to tack on a little bit to the end of the show, Mickey Janis is the knuckleballer in AA right now. So we'll keep a, keep an eye on that. He's doing all right now. Not great, 4.56 ERA. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. Well, everybody, enjoy the game. It's West Coast baseball, you know, keeping us up at night, hopefully. Let's just root for one way or the other. Well, you know, definitely with the Mets win. But let's not have an extra inning game, right? You know, I'll speak for myself, and I don't know about anybody else, but I could definitely use some more sleep. So let's go Mets, pedal to the metal, and, you know, enjoy watching the Dodgers series. Oh, and if you get a chance, definitely tune into Vin Scully a little bit because it's his last season. So I'm probably going to be listening to the I know they simulcast for the first four games, and Vin Scully will be on the radio. And because of the blackout, I won't be able to watch the TV. But I'm probably going to listen to Vin Scully for the first four innings. And let's go Mets. It's check Vin Scully out. It's his last season. So anyway, have a good one, everybody.
Have a good one.
Let's go Mets.
And meet the Mets.
Good night.
Good night.